From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for November 22nd, 2019. Checking the calendar, Elvis Costello is at the Miller High Life Theater this Tuesday night. Waukesha's own Frank Caliendo is at Pottawatomie for two shows Saturday. The Packers are back on the left coast with the 49ers Sunday night, and the Bucks are home Monday with the Jazz and Wednesday with Atlanta. All right, a child prodigy from Belgium is on course to get his bachelor's degree at the age of 9. The boy genius and I have something in common. It also took me 9 years to get my degree. And when did this seem like a good idea? A Hawaiian surfer dude proposed to his girlfriend while surfing. He, of course, dropped the ring right into the ocean. A nightclub in Dubai began a promotion offering women free drinks based on how much they weigh. When did that seem like a good idea? Even with the drink incentive, those women will still miraculously lose 15 pounds when asked. And finally, what's wrong with this picture? A taxi driver used a translator to tell the judge his English is good enough for a cab license. What are the chances this guy gets lost a lot? In the studio, we have Brian Kilb, Steve Giles, Isabel Wimero, Joel Dreesang. And wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. A busy week in politics with impeachment testimony ongoing and a Democratic presidential debate this week. But despite the political news, stock markets have remained relatively subdued. The S&P 500 has closed within 1% of the previous day's close across the last 30 trading days. While calm stretches such as this are not unprecedented, it does speak to the lack of excitement investors feel about the current news cycle. For the week, the NASDAQ down 0.2%, closing at 85.20. The S&P 500 down 0.3%, closing at 31.10. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.5% to close at 27,874. For the year, the NASDAQ up 29.5%, including dividends. The S&P 500 up 26.1%, including dividends. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 21.7%. The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury moved down this week, closing the week at 1.77%. That's a quick look at the week. Brian, I think it's the time of year when we tend to get a lot of capital market assumptions from the firms that we do business with, from the economic firms out there, from the asset managers out there, kind of their view of what risk and return looks like for the next year, for the next 5 years, for the next 10. J.P. Morgan, one of the bigger asset management shops out there, came out with their forecast for the next 10 to 15 years. They say a 60-40 stock bond portfolio is going to earn 5.4% over the next 10 to 15 years on an annualized basis. And that 5.4% number may be a little bit less than what we would have been talking to clients about 10 years ago. Certainly, if you do the math on that 60-40 portfolio and what we've always said is a 4% withdrawal rate, 6% was enough to get you there plus 2% for inflation. And obviously that number that Morgan's throwing out there now is a little less than that. And so I think, first and foremost, we've talked about it a bit in this room. We've put it in the newsletter. But I think there's some reason for investors to maybe adjust their expectations down a little bit from the returns we have seen to, I think, what we expect. And a variety of reasons for that maybe we can discuss a little bit. But I think more importantly, the question is, what do investors do about this?
Kyle, and I don't know that the answer is it going to be 5.4 or something closer to a historical norm of maybe 7.5? I mean, you and I look at Morningstar forecast quite a bit. Their 10-year numbers are probably somewhere in between there. But I think the important thing is to have some idea of what might happen in your portfolio or your planning strategy if it leans one way or the other. And I do think, we're all about setting expectations, whether it's from a planning standpoint or from a portfolio development standpoint. And I think if you were to look at the lay of the land and allow yourself to have a lower set of expectations going forward, considering what's going on, and you translate that into some numerical value and play with the math a little bit, I think it's a useful exercise to go through. That we have all kinds of different folks coming in here every day, and while we may apply some academics and some science to building portfolios. It's still about what you think is going to make you comfortable in your own risk assessment, you know. So I think having an answer and having some expectation going forward about how you're going to feel in any of those environments is what this whole thing is about, and building a portfolio is going to make you comfortable.
You know, Brian and Kyle, I think it's also worth pointing out that the active management involved in turning off the spigot of stock withdrawals when the market goes down needs to be taken into account. You can maintain a 4% withdrawal rate during periods of market weakness by leaning on the bond component of your portfolio.
Well, but let's remember, with that bond component, 10 years ago, you buy a 10-year U.S. Treasury, you're getting maybe 3% on that money. So that's now come due because you bought it 10 years ago, you get paid 3% for those 10 years. Now you got to turn around and buy a new 10-year bond, you're looking at less than 2%. And so that's, I think, a big piece of what's forced us to adjust those expectations lower. The other piece is that 10 years ago, you were talking about a market that was 15, 20% undervalued in terms of stocks. And now you're talking about a stock market that's maybe 4 or 5% overvalued. And so I think, you know, Brian, one of the things you and I talked about was the need to maybe refocus some of what we're looking at. It's not just about stocks and bonds necessarily. You know, in particular, there's income-producing investments out there that maybe provide a level of income that can get you to 5 or 6 the way bonds couldn't before. Certainly, there's risks to that, but, you know, there's other ways beyond strictly looking at a 60-40 portfolio.
Well, and I think there's also, I mean, there's so many different contextual ways to look at this, but if you're looking 10-year numbers and I'm retiring at 65, I mean, I know a lot of 95-year-old people, it's still a 30-year period, you know, and you could base your strategy on a 10-year number, but what if the next 10 years are slightly under expectation and the next 20 are over? You're still back to historical norms, you know. I think the other thing is how would you strategize between now and then? You know, what would you do differently? One of the benefits perhaps in those estimates right now, if the equity numbers are lower and maybe interest rates are lower, is that inflation's lower. So what you lose some in return, you get back potentially in a lower inflation number, you know. And then I think to the point I think you're getting at now is, are there things out there that we can use that would maybe change the dynamic of that? Could, for instance, real estate be an asset category that provides an enhanced level of return or stability, perhaps even in a period when other things might not be progressing as much as they are? And I think part of our job is to look ahead and find those things and do the best we can with your portfolio to maximize the return with the risk involved.
Brian, I think the interesting, or one of the many interesting parts of what you just said in particular, is this concept of long term. And I know, Joel, we had a question from a client at the seminar that was talking about how, you know, we talk about long term, but her long term is very different than somebody else's long term. And so I think, you know, some of this is definitional here. Some of this is, what do you consider to be long term? And it's one thing to say 10 years, but as you rightfully point out, if you're 65 today and you've just retired, your long term isn't just, okay, what do we need over the next couple of years? You've got to look, you know, what happens if I live to 95? What happens if I live to 100? And the reality is that the market 30 years from now, that our investments 30 years from now are going to look very different than they do today. And, you know, we saw that with maybe how we would have invested in markets like China 10 years ago or even 15 years ago, where, yeah, maybe it was a small piece of the overall pie, but it was a piece nonetheless. And now we're looking at, you know, what's the next market that has that kind of growth potential? And so, you know, you look at countries that have huge demographic trends in their favor, you know, India, for example. Then you look at countries that I think have been underdeveloped for years, like Africa. And Brian, I know, you know, in addition to, you know, the real estate conversation we had earlier, I think, you know, some of these alternative ideas, maybe that we wouldn't have been so willing to dive into before, likely to be a part of those longer-term portfolios as we advance.
So if we just focused on China for a minute, and not because of tariffs and politics and all that, but just because of how we thought about China 10 years ago and how we think about China now, we're all kind of asking ourselves, well, gee, you know, will China be the number one economy? Will China ultimately dominate things? And you have to remember that 10 years ago, nobody thought China would be China today. You know, and I'm old enough to remember, you know, when we all thought Japan was going to dominate the world, and they ran into some demographic issues and other problems. It could be that China does exactly the same thing and looks exactly that way 10 years from now, which then begs the question of, well, what's going to be working 10 years from now that we don't even know today? You know, and I think what you have to allow yourself is the possibility that it's going to be something. You know, maybe it's Africa, or maybe it's space, or maybe it's something we aren't even talking about. But it's really hard to predict, you know, what's going to happen 15 years from now, when so many things are going to happen that we don't even know yet, you know?
Well, and I think so critically important that as investors, we explore some of those things we're interested in,
exactly,
because they very well could be the things that 10 years from now are what's driving returns. You know, maybe transitioning a little bit from kind of the longer-term look to what's going to happen here in the next 32 days, and going to be a mad rush into the Christmas season this year, especially when you consider that we've got a shortened holiday period. Isabel, I know you had some thoughts on kind of what consumer spending looks like, what holiday sales are going to look like. I wonder if you could share those with us.
Yeah, so we saw in our economic indicators this week that consumer sentiment rose in November, and consumers are feeling really good about their personal financial situation, which should be helping fuel consumer spending this year. Like you just said, we're about to be in the biggest shopping season of the year, so it's going to be really interesting to see what trends we have with spending and how that's going to affect some of these big realtors. You know, if you look at returns by sector for the year, companies that are categorized as discretionary have not been leading the pack. And we're in this earnings season right now where we're getting numbers back from some of these big names like Macy's, Nordstrom's, people like that. And they are saying that they've beat their third quarter estimates, but they're also not sounding super enthusiastic in their forecasts. So we're going to have to see what some of these companies are going to do going forward in the holiday season to try to win over some of these shoppers.
And retail spending and the consumer more broadly is something that I'm writing about for next week's newsletter. If you're not subscribed, I'd encourage you to check it out. I think a lot of good stuff shows up in there about kind of the way we see the world right now, kind of about how we build portfolios. But I think, you know, more importantly on the consumer front, some good information every year that comes from Deloitte that looks at, okay, what does that spending look like? And in particular, they're saying this year that, you know, they expect maybe 4.5% or 5% growth in spending, that, you know, spending around the holiday season accounts for about a quarter of total spending, consumer spending during the year. And so when you look at that and you start to think, okay, how big of a piece of the pie is holiday spending? It's a pretty big deal to see where we finish in this last quarter. A pretty big deal to say, okay, here's what that means for how the consumer really feels about the world. And then maybe one more thing, and that is that unfortunately we're not going to see as much of the growth in the retail spending as we have in previous years. If you look at a lot of the studies suggesting that a lot of the big spending comes in the form of experiences. It comes in the form of eating out. It comes in the form of social interactions. It's not, you know, it's no longer the Red Ryder BB gun and the bunny pajamas. It's, you know, let's go out and have this meal, or let's go take a trip somewhere.
And Kyle, that's a good point. But that's still consumer spending, and that still, you know, helps fuel the economy, whether we categorize it as, you know, retail sales or something else. You know, that's all important. And, you know, good. Isabel pointed out that great number from the consumer sentiment today. So the University of Michigan has been doing these surveys for more than 50 years, and it's reached the highest level now for consumer confidence in their personal financial situation. And that's like the key number that propels consumer spending from those surveys. Another point I wanted to make was, although there are six fewer shopping days this year between Black Friday and Christmas Eve, it's the shortest shopping season you can ever get, just the way Thanksgiving falls. But the National Retail Federation isn't all that concerned about it. Based on their surveys, 39% of consumers say that they start their holiday shopping in October or earlier.
That's insane.
You know, not everybody runs out to the 7-Eleven on Christmas Eve like Max always does.
Well, I know that tends to be the story we get from you every year, Max, that 7-Eleven's the place to be.
Donuts and everything.
but it's
you know, I'm sure you guys saw that Alibaba did $32 billion in a 24-hour period. So that's more than we do in that 5 days. They kind of consider Black Friday. But, you know, and there's a whole different comparison between what's going on with retail here and there. But it's still, that's an astounding number, you know. That's a lot of sales of something. I don't know what it is, but.
And trying to import another holiday into the U.S., I think, with Singles Day from China. Yeah. So, you know, one more reason maybe to spend some money. You know, Steve, it's all about earnings and interest rates. We've got some news from the Federal Reserve this week in the form of the minutes that came from their October meeting. We knew the cut happened, you know, reducing the overnight rate by 25 basis points. But, you know, I think some additional clarity that they continue to be focused on kind of the direction of the economy. And then the earnings piece, that maybe earnings in the third quarter not as bad as we thought, but still a negative number. I wonder what clients are asking you about right now with respect to earnings and interest rates and what you're telling them.
Well, the wild card, Kyle, continues to be tariffs and the trade war. As much as we're looking at favorable earnings yields here domestically, as you pointed out earlier, the market historically relative to its PE is a bit higher than its historical average. But the degree of support that we're continuing to see with the market, and I think a lot of the reason why the market has been setting highs recently, is because that 10-year Treasury number is so low. And with no indication from the Fed that they're going to be going higher, and with consensus forecasts being such that they're either going to hold or go lower between now and the end of next year, I could paint a pretty compelling picture why a moderately balanced 60-40 portfolio is the place to be for the intermediate term.
Yeah, you know, I think the adage of don't fight the Fed seems to be continue to be appropriate here. And so, you know, I think you're spot on there.
You know, I wonder if now that we've hit a point where I think what was the terminology they used, but something material would have to happen to make them raise or lower rates. So maybe they're giving the markets a signal they're not going to do anything for a while. So now don't fight the Fed, you know, well, we don't have to worry about the Fed for a while. So I wonder what markets will pay attention to in the months ahead if the discussion about the Fed and of the Fed is quiet for a while, you know.
Well, and consider that on the earnings front, a lot of the issue this year has been the unwillingness of corporations to spend and kind of the freezing of corporate spending plans that's resulted in, you know, either negative earnings growth or, you know, just very flat earnings growth. And as you fast forward to 2020, now the headwinds of those issues are off the books, and unless things get worse, at the very least, you've got a neutral environment. And if you see some of that maybe improve a little bit, if you see some softening there, you could have some tailwinds to trade that I think help earnings as well. And so even with a little bit of good news, we could be pleasantly surprised there.
Agreed.
Joel, maybe not quite as exciting week for economic news, but a few things worth pointing out. In particular, a lot of news on the housing front this week.
Yeah, Kyle, we had a couple of numbers on housing, and one hits to that last point that you made, and it's about housing starts and building permits. And, I mean, in some ways, that's not so much a consumer number as it is, I mean, consumers are demanding that stuff, but it's a business confidence number. And those numbers are up. The number of starts are up, the number of building permits being taken out. So, you know, that's maybe indicating that at least that industry, that businesses are kind of getting off the schneid and feeling a little more confident about, you know, being able to sell those houses. And the other number is that we got is existing home sales from the National Association of Realtors. And that was up. It's, you know, housing isn't robust, but it's still plodding along. It's sort of like the economy. It's showing that you know, there's still growth out there. It's sluggish, it's volatile, but you know, there's still something going on. And again, that upper number for existing home sales, I think, is an indication of consumer not only confidence but capacity. I mean, if you're willing to go out and buy a house, that's probably saying that you feel pretty good about where you are financially and that you're able to cover the costs.
Well, and let's also remember that housing is a decision that so often is driven by affordability, and rates have certainly helped the affordability equation recently. And so, you know, housing was one of the first sectors to be hit by rising interest rates, that when you start to tighten that market, when you start to tighten the lending market, you know, housing's going to slow down a little bit. And interestingly, It is the first, I think, that's starting to show some signs of stabilization now that we've cut rates a little bit.
And the other aspect of housing affordability is the fact that there's been a shortage of houses for sale. So that's why those new houses being built is helping to furnish that. The National Association of Realtors said that for 92 months in a row, the year-to-year price, median price of home sales has been going up. So that's showing that housing shortage.
Well, and I think the last thing to throw in there is we've had this kind of generation of people that have waited longer to buy their first home for a host of reasons. And as that kind of demographic ages, you're getting some older couples that are starting to, you know, if they were 25 before and they're 30 now, you got a five-year gap that's starting to be closed, and those people are ready to go out there and buy their first home, and that will certainly increase demand and change the market in and of itself.
Brian, that's a good point, and I think
thanks,
that's
Joel.
often underestimated is the demographics, especially in housing. And if you talk about, you know, younger people with monstrous student loans, and you know, that sort of sets the whole equation of when you get a house, if you get a house.
My own daughter put an offer on a house last week. There were 8 other offers. So, you know, that tells you something about the housing market. Now, whether it's a demand or a supply issue, we could, again, talk about for a while, but there's a need for housing. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that we see a higher, you know, higher level of home permits this month, you know, whether it's a one-month spike or a trend, we'll see. But I think there's a need out there for housing, so we'll see.
And important to point out that residential investments only 4% of GDP,
right.
But the pieces surrounding it, you know, the consumption that's necessary to furnish homes is a far bigger overall piece. And so encouraging to see some positive signs, I think, on that front.
Well, Brian, one of your clients recently told me about how he and his wife got a house. I think they got a new place like last summer. And he said that he didn't realize, but there's some sort of unwritten rule that when you get a new house, you have to get entirely new furniture.
It's funny you say that, because that's exactly where I was going, you know, because then you, especially your first home, right, you need garbage cans and curtains and, you know, all the stuff you really, well, I suppose you had a garbage can in your apartment, but maybe you need a few more of them or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? There's this whole,
it has to be a new one.
You know, it's 5 trips to Home Depot every other weekend, and it does have a ripple effect just beyond that you know, structure itself and stuff. So,
well, and that's why the housing starts number, Brian, is so important.
Agreed.
Compared to, say, the existing home sales. Existing home sales, the home's already built.
Yep.
Housing starts means
you're,
you got a construction company that's got to hire workers that you know, have to get to and from the job site and new pickup trucks. And, you know, there is a multiplier effect in those indicators.
Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.